It'd be hard to blame anyone who watches TV news, reads the New York Times, or even listens regularly to this radio show for believing that the world is an increasingly violent place. But extensive historical research has convinced psychologist Steven Pinker that the opposite is true, that we're actually living during the most peaceful time in human history. In an effort to convince the rest of us, Professor Pinker has written The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, a book that's over 800 pages and weighs in at nearly 3 pounds. Steven Pinker is an award-winning scientist, a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and the author of 7 previous books, several of them bestsellers. His latest is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You've called this decline in violence the most significant development in the history of our species. What makes it so significant?
Well, it's hard to accomplish anything else if you have to worry about being kidnapped, raped, or murdered. And it's hard to build institutions of governance or science or art if they're looted and burned as quickly as they're built.
But we read about people in many countries like Mexico, for example, who are being raped, kidnapped, and burned.
What that
says... Beheaded just the other day, I read in Mexico City.
Well, what that shows is that violence across the planet has not gone down to zero. And so if you trawl the news for any violent event, you're going to find plenty of them. The question is, what about all those people in Poland and Lithuania and Angola and Argentina who aren't getting blown up? The news agencies don't send camera crews out to watch them dying peacefully in bed. And so if you don't actually calculate the proportions, you can be misled about the rate of violence in the world if all you're doing is remembering the violent incidents.
Although people are complaining that we haven't been covering what's going on in Congo, for example, enough, the most destructive war since World War II. I'm curious about the reaction that you're getting to this claim. You've said that you've been met with skepticism and credulity and sometimes even anger.
Mm-hmm.
Any idea why some people are reacting with anger? Has anybody threatened you with violence in this nonviolent time?
That would be very embarrassing. For one thing, people feel that if you make light of the violence that continues to occur, it's a sign of indifference or callousness. And the way to keep up the heat on activist causes is to emphasize how terrible things are. Of course, I argue the opposite. Namely, if people really think that the world is hopeless, there's nothing you can do, Africa is just a hellhole, why even bother? That's, I think, what encourages complacency. I think what encourages intelligent activism is the realization that some things really do work. It's not true that Africa will always be consumed by war. Rates of war have gone way down. And so let's figure out what people did right.
My guest is Steven Pinker. His book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Your book's been getting some terrific reviews. Booklist called it this long, well-researched, comprehensive tour de force. Provides a helpful look at the human condition. But in her review in the October 3rd issue of The New Yorker, Elizabeth Colbert complained that you focus most of your attention on Western Europe and much less on Asia, Africa, and South America.
I have a whole chapter on war in the rest of the world, which actually has graphs of war in Asia and South America and Africa. I also have a map of homicide rates across the world. It is true that we have better historical records for Europe, simply because the records are kept there so long. And so when it comes to things like tracing homicide trends over the centuries, Europe is where the data exist. But I have a very extensive discussion of war in these parts of the world, and what I show is it's gone down. Fewer people are dying violently in Asia, Africa, and South America.
So how do you explain the fact that we feel that there's so much violence going on? Are our brains programmed to hold on to the violent images that we see on television? There's that local news adage, if it bleeds, it leads.
Indeed. And that interacts with a feature of human cognitive psychology called the availability bias, discovered by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, namely that we don't assess probability by calculating the number of events and dividing by the number of opportunities for the event to occur. What we do is we consult memory. If we can think of some examples, then we think something is frequent. And, of course, human memory will be impressed by the gory, the recent, the dramatic. And so our assessment of the probability, combined with this news policy, is going to inflate our sense of danger. Plus, we care more about violence than we used to. We care about a larger class of victims. And so part of the increased sensitivity to violence, ironically, is one of the things that I think helped drive violence down. My favorite example is the recent emphasis on bullying. We have no one less than the President of the United States giving a speech to stamp out bullying. Now, 20 years ago, this would have been a joke. Of course, kids on the playground have to engage in this kind of play. How else are they going to toughen up? But now we've aimed our sights at a brand new category of violence. We might even think that it's increased because we start to notice it and categorize it as violence as opposed to boys being boys. But this increased sensitivity makes us think that it's actually increased in number.
We have seen a change in the way government deals with violence. Some of the descriptions of violence and torture you've included in this book are pretty gruesome, and most of them were imposed by people in power: burning, breaking bodies, disembowelment, impalement, people being sawn in half. And that was actually the norm not all that long ago.
That's right. The prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution was part of a wave of abolitions of judicial torture taking off in the 18th century. We like to think that our own Constitution was in the forefront of this, but in fact the United States was kind of in the middle of the pack among major countries that abolished or outlawed gruesome torture.
This grew out of the Enlightenment?
It grew out of the Enlightenment. There were arguments where the Enlightenment thinkers, Voltaire, Benjamin Rush, came up with arguments, and most notably Cesare Beccaria, an Italian sociologist, we would call him today, of not just a moralistic outrage, but also arguments that this was counterproductive. It would make people callous. It wouldn't deter crime. It's hypocritical if we criticize other civilizations like Islamic countries for their cruelty, but we're even worse. So all of these intellectual briefs did catch on and influenced, among others, the constitutional framers.
One of our Supreme Court justices, Clarence Thomas, has argued that some of the things that many people consider cruel and unusual punishment today are not really covered by that, because the cruel and unusual punishment that the framers were thinking of were just these awful things, disembowelment and the like. And of course, that's not happening in our prisons today.
That's right. Our standards have changed. This gets into the debate as to how one ought to interpret the Constitution and the semantics of the actual wording. But he does raise a point that what we consider cruel and unusual now is a lot less cruel and unusual than what the framers had in mind.
Is this a new idea that violence is actually on the decline? Have other scientists been studying it?
Very few scientists, but I actually was inspired to write this book when a number of scholars wrote to me and said there's evidence, a lot of evidence for a decline of violence that we know about in our fields, but the word hasn't gotten out, such as scholars of war who have been astonished that since 1945, no two rich countries have gone to war with each other, and no two Western European countries have gone to war with each other, and the superpowers, the U.S. and the USSR, didn't go to war. We almost forget that this is the dog that didn't bark, but this is very unusual in European history. Wars between France and Germany and Austria and Italy were the rule rather than the exception, and then they stopped. So that's one example. Another one is the people in Scandinavia and British Columbia who tally the human costs of war. Every year they issue a report of how many people died in wars throughout the world. They looked at their graphs. They plunged downward and were amazed, and they wrote to me and said, well, you've written about decline of violence. You should talk about this trend.
Now, when we talk about the decline of violence, how far back are we going?
I think that we can go back thousands of years, that even the first major human transition from an anarchic life as tribal hunter-gatherers and hunter-horticulturalists to the first settled states with cities and government. That was the first major decline in violence, and you saw a reduction of deaths from tribal raiding and feuding of perhaps a factor of five.
because 2,000 years ago, the remains of people reveal there was a surprisingly high percentage of people who died by violent means. I guess that's what Thomas Hobbes was referring to when he claimed that life was nasty, brutish, and short.
Yes, he was writing from the armchair, and he had no idea what life was like in a state of nature, which allowed his opposite side, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, to claim that nothing can be more gentle than man in his primitive state, and anyone could have a go at speculating because there weren't any data. But now we do have data. There's a kind of CSI Paleolithic where forensic archaeologists can examine prehistoric skeletons for signs of violent trauma. And they've often come up with astonishing figures that as many as 15% of the skeletons that you find in ancient digs have cut marks and arrowheads embedded in bones and signs of decapitation and so on.
And cannibalism.
And cannibalism, indeed.
You've said that you got some figures from Matthew White, a self-described atrocitologist, the author of The Great Big Book of Horrible Things.
Hasn't come out yet, but it's a wonderful book. He also calls himself a necromatrician. But he has tried to do, there are a small number of people who've tried to at least come within an order of magnitude of how horrible the atrocities were of the past. Because although it's a cliche that the 20th century was the most violent in history, where are the numbers from all those earlier centuries that would allow you to make such a claim? And so he, by combing over the historical sources, he's tried to, one can never get a precise estimate, but to pick figures and plausible figures in the middle of the range. And I relied a lot on data from him and from Rudolf Rummel, another atrocitologist.
So would a genocide of the past have been worse than what we saw with the Holocaust, or even more recently with Rwanda, where nearly a million people were killed in just 100 days?
Probably not in absolute numbers, but of course the world was much smaller at the time. As a proportion of the population, absolutely. The deaths from the various sieges and sackings during the Crusades added up to probably about a million, which is proportionally about the same as the Nazi Holocaust compared to the population of the world. And the Mongols would round up the inhabitants of cities throughout South Asia and the Middle East and massacre every last one of them.
What about the Spanish Inquisition or the witch hunts that took place in Europe between the 15th and 18th century? I understand something like 100,000 women were killed for being witches.
Exactly. Screwball, superstitious reasons. The Inquisition, it's harder to tell, but some estimates say 350,000. The Catholic Church disputes that, not surprisingly, but it was a lot.
My guest is Steven Pinker, the Harvard College professor of psychology and two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, winner of many awards for his research, teaching, and books, named one of Time's 100 most influential people in the world today and Foreign Policy's 100 global thinkers. His latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, is published by Viking. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Steven Pinker. His latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It's published by Viking. To compare the level of violence at different points in history, you look not only at the number of people who were killed, but you came up with a rate at which they were killed. You've suggested that earlier, based on the population where they lived at the time. We explain how this actually works?
You mean why calculate violence as a proportion of the population?
Is this a common way for historians to make comparisons between very different time periods?
Some of them. I think it's the appropriate metric. Now, granted, there's a philosophical question as to whether it's worse, say, for 200 people to die in a population of 100 or 2 million in a population of 2 billion, for example. Should we take into account the total amount of suffering? Or should we also take into account that a lot of people alive at the time lived fulfilling lives and died of peaceful causes, and all of the happiness that they enjoyed in their lives should be counted as a good against which we weigh the bad of the people who died violently? And of course, any time a baby is born, there's some chance that they'll die of a horrible accident as well, or get eaten by a predator. So if you ask the question, What are the chances that I would be a victim of violence if I were time transported back to that time, or how much harm was done as a proportion of the amount of human life, and therefore the amount of good? Then that says that you should be looking at proportions, and so that's mainly what I did.
But there's also the quality of life living in Germany during the time of the Holocaust. If you were Jewish, or you were a gypsy, or you were gay, or you were politically incorrect by Nazi standards, or living in the Soviet Union under Stalin, or China under Mao, anybody, millions, hundreds of millions died ultimately, but also lives were miserable on top of that.
True enough.
I mean, I don't know if that's any, if it was any better during the 30 Years' War.
Probably not, by the way. But in general, consistent with the practice of a lot of historians, since deaths are the easiest thing to count, they're not a bad proxy for every other measure of violence. Now, rates of rape and assault and kidnapping don't always track the homicide rate, but they often do. And I think it's a good bet that in societies where a lot of people are being killed, those are also societies in which the lives of the people who aren't killed aren't so happy either. Among other things, just the threat of being killed, the terror and the fear.
But you discovered that people were killed at a higher rate during the Crusades, during the 11th, 12th, and 13th century, than during the Nazi Holocaust?
I calculated as a proportion of the world's population. If you calculate it as a proportion of Europe's population, it would have been even more dramatic. But, the reason that I used the world population is just to not give myself too much freedom to jigger the numbers, because the smaller the reference population, the bigger your number could be. I use the population of the world just so that everyone would know that I was using a constant yardstick, and I had no freedom to fiddle with the numbers.
We have things like the 30 Years' War, which I mentioned, which took place between 1618 and 1648 in what's now Germany. And you say it was proportionately double the number of people who were killed during World War I, and very similar to the number of people who were killed in Europe during World War II. Of course, we're comparing 30 years with 5 years of World War II.
Yes, that's right. And again, there is the almost philosophical question of whether it's worse to have a very intense period of killing that's over soon, or a slower rate of killing, but one that goes on much longer and accumulates a larger number of victims as a proportion of the world's population.
But are you suggesting that during those times, human life was valued less? We're more horrified by Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, and anyone else who does that sort of thing, or what's going on right now in Syria, because it is so callous, and in the past it might just have been considered a normal way of life?
Absolutely. And one can see signs of the increased valuation of human life, partly in the fact that historians didn't even find genocide particularly interesting. They loved wars with the big armies meeting the battlefield, making lots of noise. When you have men with arms preying on defenseless civilians, that doesn't make for such a good story. And so the historians just didn't write about genocide. Didn't even have a word for genocide until 1944. But it's clear the genocides took place. They're narrated in all of the in the Old Testament, in Homer. It was just a part of life. It's recently that the victims of massacres and sieges and sackings are players in the story of what unfolded.
A caller asks, most people no longer see animals slaughtered the way they did at one time. Could that difference be affecting the level of human violence?
It's a good question. I don't take it up in the book, but I have wondered about that. I do write about the fact that there is nowadays more of a horror in any kind of penetration of the body envelope. We're particularly sickened by forms of torture and mutilation that were common in the Middle Ages and early modern period. And I imagine that they must have been easier to carry out at that time when people were routinely slaughtering animals with their own hands.
But we do see them in the movies. Does that become a surrogate experience?
I think it does.
Makes us less callous than actually seeing somebody killed before our eyes?
I think violent entertainment is a real constant of human experience. We
People went to hangings in the old days.
People went to hangings in the old days, and worse than hangings, they went to see people drawn and quartered and disemboweled and burned at the stake and so on. And we still like to consume simulated violence. And in fact, you could go to a cinemaplex and see the most gory explosions and decapitations and blood flowing across the screen. And then at the end of the picture, it says no animals were harmed in the making of this motion picture. So people do wall off entertainment from real life, because I don't think there's been a reduction in violence in our entertainment, even as there has been a reduction in everything from the homicide rate to the rate of spanking.
And on video games. You can kill thousands.
Absolutely.
You've described this book as being a tale of five trends, five inner demons, four better angels, and five historical forces. If my math is correct, that makes 20 elements. Do we need to understand all 20 to appreciate how and why the world has become less violent?
I think we do. Six of them are purely historical. Nine of them are psychological, and then the remaining five bring the history and psychology together. That's because there's this old debate, are people basically good or basically evil? And that's just a bad question. We obviously have, human nature is extraordinarily complex. We've got a brain with 100 billion neurons and 100 trillion connections. There's not going to be a yes or no answer to whether people are innately violent. And so what I try to do is tease apart the different kinds of violence that people are prone to. There's a big difference between raw exploitation, just eliminating natives because you want their land, versus moralistic killing out of revenge, where you hate the person and believe that it's moral that they die, even if it costs you something. So that's just two categories of violence. And then likewise, on the positive side, the better angels of our nature, as Lincoln called them, there's not just one reason that we refrain from violence. I think there are a number of them. And so the interplay between the various inner demons, as I call them, and the various better angels, I think can, I hope, explain the trajectory of violence over time.
Well, people often wonder how people who for a long time live perfectly peacefully together suddenly can find themselves in situations where the men are raping their neighbors without thinking twice about it, or killing their people who've been their friends, as we saw in Czechoslovakia after the Germans took over, in Austria, and then places like Rwanda. There's a line that has to be crossed.
There is, although often in genocides there's a long buildup of either demonization of another group, namely they're humans and they made an evil choice, or dehumanization, namely they're not even human to begin with, they're vermin. And most genocides are preceded by a mindset of demonizing or dehumanizing a group.
In Rwanda, they called the Hutus who were doing the killing, called the Tutsis cockroaches.
Yes, indeed. And of course, Hitler had a number of...
he called Jews rats.
He had every biological metaphor in the book. They were they had poisonous blood. They were parasites. They were bloodsuckers. And interesting that the metaphor is always biological.
The six trends you've cited all seem connected to the idea of creating or advancing civilization. Do you see the formation of the first organized civilizations of 5,000 years ago as being the first step in this decrease in violence?
They definitely drove the numbers down. That is, life under the first governments was safer than life in anarchic tribal feuding and raiding.
Even if the ruler is not a benevolent ruler?
The rulers were definitely not benevolent, and they didn't do this pacification out of any kind of benevolent motives. Basically, they had the same motive as a farmer who prevents his livestock from killing each other. Namely, from his point of view, it's a dead loss. He'd rather have the serfs are alive to provide him with cannon fodder and taxes and tribute, and so it's in his interest that they don't kill each other, which is just a waste. So I don't think there was any benevolence in it. It had the somewhat happy byproduct of lowering the rate of death, but often by quite brutal means.
Do you think that just the development of communities and cities forces us to become less violent because we have to get along with our neighbors?
I think there is some of that. I think that when you're rubbing shoulders with people who are unlike you, it can be a little harder to demonize them or dehumanize them. I think that there's evidence that cosmopolitan mixing of peoples and awareness of other peoples can drive down levels of hatred. And also a lot of reforms, like the idea of democracy, the idea of human rights, they tend to be cooked up in cities where you have a lot of people getting together in the salons and coffee houses and arguing with each other.
And arguing is a lot better than killing each other because you disagree.
It's better for two reasons. One of them is you're not killing each other, and the other is better ideas can emerge in the crucible of argument.
But there are people who will argue that one of the reasons we've seen a lower murder rate in recent years is simply because of demographics, not because of any change in our attitude toward our fellow humans.
Yeah, the demographics don't quite work. That is, if you take it for granted that most violence is committed by young men from between 15 and 30, and you just look at the number or the proportion of young men following the various baby booms and busts, it really doesn't predict the homicide rate very well. So during the 1960s, the baby boomers should have increased the homicide rate by their numbers by about 15%, but it actually went up by 150%. Likewise, when the homicide rate crashed in the 90s, every demographic prediction predicted it would go the other way, and there'd be actually more violence rather than less.
So how do we explain that? Are these just little cyclical changes?
The honest answer is that no one knows for sure, but my friends in statistical criminology say just demographics won't do it, and you really have to appeal to a cultural change. That's what I try to do in the book. I think, and I feel like a traitor to my generation saying this, but I think the 60s, the mindset of the counterculture, of questioning authority, of acting on impulse, actually contributed to a cultural change that led the violence rate to go up.
Well, we're seeing something similar right now with the Tea Party on the one side and the protesters on Wall Street and other parts of the country on the other. Might this suggest more violence sometime in the near future?
The interesting thing is that neither the Tea Partiers nor the Wall Street occupiers have been at all violent. And in fact, since the
Except against the language in some cases.
Yes, that's right. We can live with that. Better the language than flesh and blood. Interestingly, since the Great Recession of 2008, the homicide rate has dropped every single year since. Again, confounding all kinds of predictions.
Ken on the Upper West Side wonders whether an explanation for the reduction in violence in the modern era might be related to the increase in the participation of women in politics and society in general, at least in the West.
I think that's a good bet, and the empowerment of women is one of my five historical forces. You can see that anthropologically, that tribal societies that treat their women better also kill each other less. And you see it in public opinion polls where women are always more dovish than men in their voting patterns.
But even in the human discourse, we're seeing changes. You point out that in 1950, President Truman threatened a critic at the Washington Post with bodily harm after he wrote an unkind review of a vocal performance by Margaret, the president's daughter. That's impossible to imagine today.
I think so. He'd be a candidate for anger management therapy.
But something that surprised me about your findings on the rate of violence is that it has decreased as the world's population has increased. Hasn't the idea that the world is likely to get more violent as people are crowded more closely together been pretty widely accepted?
No, the crowding hypothesis is pretty much rejected by every student of violence because there are places like Hong Kong and Amsterdam that are just teeming with people and they get along just fine.
What about climate change? Some people are saying that the fight over resources like water or food will lead to more violence.
It's certainly possible, although it's not necessary, that most wars are not fought over vital resources, and often shortages of resources from climate shocks don't lead to war. So I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I don't think it's inevitable.
Steven Pinker is the Harvard College Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, and his latest book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It is published by Viking. Have you found that people are being convinced, or do they still resist?
I think when it comes to the facts, they're convinced, but they'll still say, oh, yeah, but what about the Norwegian shooter? Oh, yeah, but what about the British riots? There's always enough examples.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.